From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. We are privileged to be recording this edition of Naps Chat at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, Louisiana. This unique museum tells the story of the American experience during the years in which America's greatest generation earned their stars and stripes. One aspect of the wartime experience was the development and the use of V-mail. V-mail does not stand for voicemail. It stands for victory mail, a form of postal correspondence that was used during World War II that enabled parents, family members, friends to communicate from the home front to the battlefield. It was a patriotic duty to mail letters to our armed forces. With me today to talk about the museum and this form of postal communications is Kimberly Geis, Senior Curator and Director of Curatorial Affairs at the National World War II Museum. Kimberly has written about V-mail, and she is also an expert historian relating to the American prisoner of war experience during World War II. Kimberly began working at the World War II Museum in 2008. Welcome to Naps Chat, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for joining me here at the museum.
Before we begin talking about V-mail and the post office during World War II, I'd like you to explain a little bit about the importance of the World War II Museum to America and to folks who may walk through your doors.
Sure. As you mentioned, we are the National World War II Museum. We focus on the American experience in World War II. We opened in 2000 as the National D-Day Museum, and in 2004, just a few short years after the opening, we received the congressional designation as the National World War II Museum, and we really began to live out our mission of telling the story of the entire war, the American experience in the war, why it was fought, how it was won, and what it means today. So we really keep that mission close at hand when we are putting together exhibits, when we're collecting material, which we still are doing today. So as World War II veterans are increasingly dying off and no longer with us, it becomes even more important to record their stories and preserve their artifacts, their oral histories, and in many instances, their personal correspondence, their mail.
So this is the repository of World War II veterans' memories that we can tap into.
Yes, it is. And we part of our mission is to preserve that material, but also to make it accessible to the public. So we have digitization efforts and publication efforts online and in print that bring the story to the public.
Let's get on to V-mail. As I understand it, V-mail was used between the years 1942 and 1945. What made V-mail so novel and essential?
V-mail is a really unique form of correspondence. And you're right, between 1942 and 1945, V-mail was used as a postal practice. So you only see it in World War II collections. People may have seen a V-mail or have heard about V-mail, but it's a little known form of correspondence. So V-mail was an innovative practice and technologically advanced practice that was put into place because of a wartime need. And as individuals go throughout our museum, we see a lot of instances of that where new innovations were tried and developed, put into practice because of a certain need. And V-mail was just such a practice. So because of the enormous amount of mail that had to be handled and required large amounts of cargo space and transport space, V-mail was put into place. And V-mail was microphotography. So letters, full-size letters, were photographed and then reduced, essentially. So after a letter was photographed, the reel of film was shipped overseas, and then that reel was developed. The letters were developed in quarter size, and those small versions of that very same letter were then delivered to the recipient.
Now, as I understand V-mail, it was a collaborative effort that included the post office, the departments of the Army and the Navy, and the Eastman Kodak Corporation. Could you talk a little bit about that collaboration?
It was an enormous effort to get this practice underway. Kodak came into play with the equipment. So the Eastman Kodak Corporation, they had a machine called the Recordak, which I think all of the titles of all of this equipment is you know, super cool. Microphotography was not a new thing. It had been used for various other, in business practice mainly, with a machine called the Chekhograph, which is also pretty cool. But it hadn't been used on a wide scale for the mail. But Kodak had this machine called the Recordak. And so they were contacted by the War Department who entered into a contract with Kodak to be the providers of this source for the V-mail enterprise. And so Kodak produced the Recordak machines. They also trained operators to work the machines and also service the machines. So they're essentially scanners, you know, kind of a mix between a scanner and a copy machine. And they were often operated in rough environments, so they would break down a lot. You know, anyone who's ever experienced a paper jam knows, you know, what can go wrong with this type of equipment. And so Kodak was essential in training people to use this equipment, maintaining it, and in some instances, actually operating the equipment themselves.
I'm going to talk about the logistics of writing a letter, having it transported, and its receipt. Take me for example. My dad fought in the Pacific Theater during World War II aboard an assault transport ship and was involved in the Battle of Okinawa. So he's in the fighting in the Battle of Okinawa. I'm located, let's say, in Long Island, New York. I want to write a letter to my dad. What happens?
Okay, so if you want to use V-mail, and you do want to use V-mail, because V-mail was marketed as the quickest way to get a letter to your loved one overseas, and also a surefire way to get the letter there. All V-mail was transported by air, so it did, in theory, it got there quicker than a regular letter, which could have gone by via ship or another method. So if you want to write a letter to your dad, first you have to get the V-mail stationery. So that was one particular thing about V-mail. You had to use a standard type of stationery. And that you could receive from the post office, or you could also buy a commercial product, V-mail stationery. So it was essentially a form letter, you know, a blank form that you would fill in. It all had to be the same size because they had to fit through the Recordak machine. So you would use this blank form and fill in the blanks. You would write your letter as usual, except because of the size of the form, you were restricted to a certain amount of text. And V-mails could fit around 700 typed words. There are actually jokes about V-mail that V-mail was God's gift to servicemen because you weren't required to write a long letter. You know, you could make it short and you had no excuse. You had an excuse. But so you could only write so much, and then your letter was folded in on itself. So it was an envelope and a letter in one. You folded this letter, you wrote the address on the outside, and then you put it in the mail, just like a regular letter.
What type of address would I write on it?
So that was also very important. If you misaddressed a letter, or if you left out some important information, like an Army serial number, or if you only wrote "Dear Dad," you know, "Dad," on the address, it was seen as almost an unpatriotic act. It was unable to be delivered in many instances. So what you wanted to include was someone's full name, their rank, their serial number, or service number, and any Army postal outfit number, any direct address. So as much information as you had available. Because of the enormous amount of individuals serving across the world, it was very difficult to track individuals' movements. There was one fantastic statistic that I read about individuals serving in the European theater. So around 7 million, there were 7,500 Robert Smiths. So imagine just writing a letter to Robert Smith. What are the chances that that letter is going to get to the right Robert Smith? So it was very important that you addressed a letter properly. And there were directions on the back of a V-mail form, lots of directions about how to address your letter, where to write. Do not write outside the lines because it wouldn't be captured by the Recordak machine. Do not, God forbid, try to kiss the letter and make a lipstick print. That really gummed up the works in the machine. So, you know, there were very particular instructions on the V-mail that allowed it to function optimally.
And it was transported. I wrote the letter. I filled out the form. The folded letter is now delivered to the post office.
Yes.
The post office sends it where?
The post office filters it to, so in the U.S., there were three huge postal centers in New York, in Chicago, and in San Francisco that had V-mail, huge V-mail processing plants. And they would film the letters there using the Recordak machine. They would film the letters, and your letter would have been one of around 1,600 letters that fit on one reel of film. So your letter would have been photographed with many others. Hopefully you didn't say any sensitive information in your letter, because then it would have been censored. All letters were, even V-mail, were subject to censorship. Mainly what was censored were was any information about troop movements and locations. But so once your letter made it to one of these giant centers at the ports of embarkation in New York, Chicago, or San Francisco, it would have been filtered further for delivery to a fleet post office, given that your father served with the Navy in the Pacific. So the reels of film were then gathered into a mailbag, and around 100 reels of V-mail film could have fit in one bag. And the V-mail process, in terms of transporting, it's estimated that it reduced the shipping needs by 98%. So just by photographing a letter and having reels of film that could fit 1,600 letters, and then shipping those reels of film instead of shipping the letters themselves, you reduced the cargo needs by 98%. And that was the central point of V-mail.
So the V-mail now was transported to the Fleet Post Office, yes. And they received the films.
They received the films.
And they reprinted,
They developed the film
mm-hmm. into letters, and it's put in an envelope at that point?
It's put into an envelope at that point and then delivered.
Mail call. Mail call aboard the ship or wherever in a field hospital. Was there any difference in the way mail was handled if it was going to the European theater or to the Pacific theater?
Well, there was a difference in terms of perhaps facilities that were available, you know, on Pacific Islands. It was often difficult to get the equipment there and get the individuals there to set up these facilities. However, there's a fantastic audio report out of the 4th Marine Division on Iwo Jima, and they were able to set up post offices within just days of the initial landings on Iwo Jima. And they handled a tremendous amount of mail. They were very close to the front lines initially.
I would assume, and this is just my guess, because of the speed with which the post offices were set up abroad or on battlefield situations, that it was terribly important to the morale of the troops to receive this mail.
Exactly. Mail was the only way to communicate with your family. And there was a tremendous amount of anxiety on the part of families here on the home front and on the part of those in service around the world.
As you said before, it was almost seen as a patriotic duty to send letters to the troops, to your family member abroad in the battle zone.
That's correct. And we have a large number of letters in our collection, and I can tell you I have read many of them. And the main topic of conversation in many of the letters is the mail itself. You know, I haven't received any mail today. Have you written? I received 10 letters today. Please write. So the mail was a huge topic of conversation and obviously of concern for many in service.
What about mail delivered, and this isn't necessarily V-mail, but correspondence with prisoners of war? Is there any way to communicate with a loved one who might be a prisoner of war?
Yes. So that is a really interesting subject, and it involves another player, the Red Cross, the International Red Cross, who was responsible for mail of prisoners of war. So they were responsible for reporting individuals as prisoners and also with instructing families on how to correspond and getting mail.
One of the things I noticed in my readings about the prisoner of war experience, it might have been one of your writings, it could have been someone else's, is that there was a different way of the treatment of prisoner of war held by the Germans versus prisoner of war held by the Japanese forces. Did that affect the delivery of mail and correspondence?
It did. So mail is actually mentioned in the Geneva Convention in relation to treatment of prisoners of war. And that's one of your rights as a prisoner under the Geneva Convention, the ability to communicate, to notify your family, and to communicate with your family. And that did not happen largely in the Pacific. So in the European theater, we had around 93,000 American POWs held by the Germans. In the Pacific, the numbers were much smaller. It was around 23,000 POWs. The death rate in the Pacific was close to 40%. So it was a very different situation, and the Geneva Convention was largely not honored. So the Red Cross was not allowed in for mail for any additional sustenance or aid.
One of the most eye-opening accounts of the prisoner of war experience, the book that I'm sure you're familiar with, I know you're familiar with, Unbroken, about Louis Zepparini
mm-hmm.
and his experience and how the mail was used against him and communications with his family. So Anyone out there who's interested in that part of the war experience, I commend that and commend the writings of you, Kimberly.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, Zamperini's experience was really different. His family was, he was declared dead. So because his family had not heard from him, he had not been reported as a POW. So, you know, some POWs in the Pacific, their families did not know that they were alive or dead for, you know, a period of years. And that's one interesting postal phenomenon related to the prisoner of war experience overall is the topic of SWAM. So shortwave amateur monitors. They were a group of individuals who would monitor shortwave broadcast, enemy broadcast. And sometimes the enemy would broadcast list of individuals who were held captive and even messages. And the shortwave monitors were a group of, you know, civilians who would listen to these broadcasts, take it upon themselves to transcribe what they heard in the broadcast, and then send postcards to the families of those mentioned in the broadcast. So that's a really interesting, that's an aside, but a really interesting phenomenon. They're called SWAM, the shortwave amateur monitors.
So these people would be listening to the radio, to shortwave, they'd hear something about a loved one who might have been held captive. They used as propaganda by one of the captors, and they would write using the little postcard to notify the family that they were in fact alive.
Yep, and sometimes the families received these postcards from the shortwave monitors before they received the official notification from the Red Cross. So they were really doing a service to these families.
Final question. One of the high mail volume periods of time is around the holidays, Christmas cards and whatever. Was V-mail used at Christmas time, or did people send Christmas cards to the troops? What happened during World War II?
People sent just about everything during the holiday season. So I think, you know, it was all over the board. Certainly they used V-mail, but people sent traditional packages. And if you're trying to get a package to a prisoner of war, for instance, people were told to send packages in July. You know, in the summer, packages were going over to POW camps in Europe via the American Red Cross.
So obviously they were not edible. Or even if they started their transit edible, they wouldn't be edible by the end of December.
Right. One of the neat stories about holiday mail and the huge backlog of material that had to be gone through and sorted and located was the story of the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion. So they were a battalion, a segregated African-American female battalion, Women's Army Corps soldiers who really fought hard to be used, to be useful, to serve their country. And they were sent over to England after months of lobbying. They were sent over to England in February 1945. When they arrived, their first task was to empty a huge warehouse of backlogged holiday mail and packages. So the descriptions of what they encountered, and they're just horrific, you know, rats who are eating these fruitcakes and these old cookies, you know.
And the rats survived.
Yeah. So they they worked through what was seen as a six-month backlog. You know, they worked through it in 3 months and really got some of those packages on their way.
Wow. That's interesting. Anyway, I want to thank Kimberly Geis for joining us today on Naps Chat. Kimberly Geis is the Senior Curator and Director of Curatorial Affairs at the National World War II Museum. Thank you for joining us, Kimberly.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to thank Naps Chat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy Naps Chat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share Naps Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
And make believe it came from you. I'm gonna